This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 77 to 78 of chapter Al-Hajj from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون وجاهدوا في الله حق جهاده هو اجتباكم وما جعل عليكم في الدين من حرج ملة أبيكم إبراهيم وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وتكونوا شهداء على الناس فأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واعتصموا بالله هو مولاكم فنعم المولى ونعم النصير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O you who believe, bow down and prostrate yourselves and serve your Lord and do good that you may succeed. and strive hard in the way of Allah, such striving as is due to Him. He has chosen you and has not laid upon you any hardship in religion. The faith of your father Ibrahim, he named you Muslims before, and in this, that the apostle may be a bearer of witness to you, and you may be bearers of witness to the people. Therefore, keep up prayer and pay the poor rate, and hold fast by Allah. He is your guardian. How excellent the guardian, and how excellent the helper.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. Tehran reacts to the EU's new sanctions on a number of Iranian officials and entities, saying that it will soon release a list of reciprocal bans. The German foreign minister echoes the top EU diplomat's remarks, saying that there are no legal grounds to list Iran's IRGC as a terrorist entity. And Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams the UN for a watered-down statement that replaced the resolution condemning Israel's settlement plans. Thanks for joining us. Iran has vowed to impose retaliatory sanctions against the EU after the bloc slapped fresh bans on Tehran over the recent riots in the country. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the countermeasures will be announced soon. The EU imposed asset freezes and visa bans on 32 individuals and two entities, including Iran's education and culture ministers. The UK has also blacklisted eight individuals. Most of those targeted are lawmakers, judiciary officials, and prison authorities. Western powers have imposed several rounds of such sanctions on Iran in recent months, accusing the country of cracking down on protesters. Tehran has repeatedly dismissed the accusations, saying it has been lawfully dealing with rioters disrupting public security. Iran says the West is using human rights as a tool in its pressure campaign against the country. Journalist and political analyst Muhammad Ali Araki tells us why the West has been imposing sanctions on Iran.
Since it started from the 1979 until now, the U.S. has tried to bring the Islamic Republic of Iran under its paws to try and get the fist over the Islamic Republic. And technically, we know that the Islamic Republic of Iran has always refused to bow down to the United States of America and its allies in the region. They have literally run out of sanctions. The United States of America have run out of sanctions. The fact that they've entered education, this shows the absolute desperation of Washington, D.C., the people in the White House or the Congress. It completely shows that. The fact that they've targeted culture. Now, we know the main war that the United States of America has with the Islamic Republic of Iran and their framework, their ideas, it's an ideological war. It's an ideological war because the United States of America has a problem with the ideology that the Islamic Republic has. And therefore, the ideology that Iran has, that is the biggest harm, the biggest threat to America and their friends. The ideology, the culture that the Islamic Republic of Iran implements, you can see this everywhere in the region. The cultural work that the Islamic Republic of Iran does, this makes the building, the structure of the United States of America wobble.
Iran has criticized the decision that excluded the country from the Munich Security Conference ending at the weekend. Tehran says the move prevented the opportunity to present alternative views to U.S. unilateralism. Earlier, we discussed this issue in our news review program.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Iran's foreign ministry has slammed the organizers of the Munich Security Conference for their decision not to invite the country for this year's meeting.
The conference was held in the name of international security, yet key countries like Iran and Russia were not invited. This eliminated the chance for the presentation of alternative viewpoints on international order and security. They prevented the expression of viewpoints different from that of the U.S. government, which seeks unilateralism on the international stage.
Khamenei said the decision not to invite Iran and Russia was a grave mistake and dealt a big blow to the reputation of the conference. The spokesman said organizers made another mistake by giving a platform to some anti-Iran elements, including the son of the former Iranian dictator, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. Khamenei called them puppets of certain countries and described their invitation to the conference as a major act of meddling in Iran's affairs. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. John Bosnich, a journalist, activist, and political analyst out of Belgrade, and John Stepling, author and commentator out of Norway. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off in Belgrade. John, what do you make of this, that instead of countries being invited, for example, in dealing with Iran, then we have opposition groups or individuals that are invited to the security conference?
Well, obviously, it's not a security conference. It's a war conference. And by exhibiting their bias, they are making it absolutely clear what they're intending to do, and that is to wage a war of aggression against Iran, to go beyond their illegal sanctions, to try to do a regime change operation in Iran. It couldn't be more clear. The idea that the legal Iranian government could not even have a representative at the conference leaves no doubt whatsoever as to the aims of the organizers, the aims of the people behind the organizers, and the aims of all of the participants.
Well, your take, John, out of Norway, it just seems that they're becoming more and more blatant and obvious and not even trying to cover under a diplomatic umbrella of trying to solve issues or work together. I mean, your take on it seems just so extreme now, the way that they're dealing with this issue, whether we're talking about the way they're treating Iran or Russia.
Well, but I think you're exactly right. The hypocrisy is extreme now. As John Bosnich said, the bias is naked and obvious to any rational person looking at this. What's interesting, though, additionally, is that the U.S. went to this conference, the Davos of Defense, as this conference is referred to, and Blinken confronted a Chinese diplomat about the Chinese balloon incident, you know, which itself is comical. I mean, how Blinken can keep a straight face talking about this Chinese weather balloon that blew off course. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of weather balloons every year launched by countries. The U.S. is just trying to foment more tension and conflict by pointing this out. This comes less than a week after Cy Hirsch publishes an article. Cy Hirsch, who has like three decades of being absolutely reliable and correct.
Right.
A Cy Hirsch article about the U.S. with help from the U.K., Norway, and Poland blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline. There's not a mention of this. Nobody breathes a word of it. The mainstream press doesn't touch it. So, I mean, you look at that, the U.S. since, I suppose, 2001, but certainly since maybe, you know, 2010 or 11, has managed to, or attempt at least, a total control of message, of media message. and they tolerate no deviance from this message. They don't allow alternative voices of any sort on any topic. The conflict in Ukraine is a perfect example. At this conference, Kamala Harris is already accusing Russia of war crimes, targeting civilians, raping children, all kinds of lurid tales, without a shred of evidence being provided. Meanwhile, Zelensky is still begging for more weapons, and the EU, Ursula von der Leyen, she with her Nazi pedigree, is encouraging EU countries to accelerate munitions production. This is, as John said, a war conference. It's nakedly a war conference. It's a massive advertisement for more war, nothing but that. It's just shocking and depressing, frankly.
On that note, I'd like to thank both of you being with me here on this news review, John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst out of Belgrade, and John Stepling, author and commentator out of Norway.
The German foreign minister says that there are no legal grounds to list Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as a terrorist organization. Annalena Baerbock's remarks echoed those by the European Union foreign policy chief last month. Josep Borrell has ruled out such a designation without a court ruling. The European Parliament called on the EU to list IRGC as a terrorist entity following the country's response to the recent riots. Iran has warned of retaliatory measures if the EU goes ahead with the blacklisting. Earlier on Monday, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, also blasted the EU for its double standards on human rights. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has denounced the UN Security Council for taking an understated stance on Israel's plan to expand settlements in the occupied territories. Hamas' condemnation comes after the UNSC fell short of passing a resolution which would have demanded the regime put an end to its settlement activities. Hamas says issuing a statement instead of passing a resolution shows the world body has evaded its responsibilities to ensure that international regulations and conventions are not violated. On Monday, the 15-member body issued a statement expressing deep concern and dismay over Israel's announcement of settlement expansion. It said the regime's scheme would jeopardize the viability of a so-called two-state solution. The statement, however, does not have the binding force of a resolution draft submitted earlier to the UNSC. Israel has recently authorized 9 settlement outposts in the occupied West Bank. The removal of an Israeli diplomat from a summit of the African Union has triggered controversy. The union says it suspended Israel's observer status to the bloc last year so that no Israeli should have attended in the first place.
We have not invited any Israeli to this assembly. We have noted that somebody entered the hall with a badge. We asked the individual to quickly leave the hall. This is a person who does not reside in Ethiopia, and we are conducting investigations to know how the individual got accredited. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen of the press, we have not invited any Israeli authorities. We are going to push this investigation to the fullest to know where the error was coming from.
Video circulating on social media shows security personnel confronting the Israeli diplomat. That's during the opening ceremony of the summit, before the diplomat leaves the auditorium. Israel has claimed its envoy was an accredited observer and has slammed South Africa and Algeria for the expulsion of the envoy. The regime attained observer status at the bloc in 2021. South Africa and Algeria protested the decision at the time. They said it runs counter to the bloc's statements in support of Palestinians. Earlier, political analyst Zafar Bangash told us about Israeli efforts to, quote, penetrate Africa.
Well, you know, we need to keep in mind that Israel is a pariah state, and it needs to be, recognized. It wants recognition, so it has been blackmailing and bribing some of the African rulers, and I'm sure that there is something untoward and illegal going on between the chairman of the African Union and Israel, because he took that decision unilaterally. But for Israel, of course, you know, it wants to penetrate Africa. It wants to claim that it is being recognized by the rest of the world. And I'm glad that South Africa and Algeria took this principled stand and they pushed for Israel's expulsion. And I also like to pay tribute to the efforts of civil society groups in South Africa, in particular Africa for Palestine and the Media Review Network, that had carried a vigorous campaign through the South African government to throw Israel out of that union and not grant them observer status.
Moroccans have held demonstrations against rising costs of food and fuel, despite a government ban on protests.
Our lives are becoming more expensive. Almost never we have experienced that before. All food prices have gone up enormously. Fuel prices have gone up, and when you know that the head of the government is the one who has the largest company in the oil sector, then you can see how interested this government is in social justice.
Protesters, mostly members of the Democratic Labour Confederation, gathered in front of Parliament in Rabat as well as in other cities. They chanted slogans against their deteriorating purchasing power. The government had placed a ban on marches after declaring a state of health emergency during the COVID-19 pandemic, but the measure still remains in force. Morocco has seen months of rising prices and growing calls for caps on energy firms' profits, but Rabat blames recent price hikes on speculation about basic goods. According to the World Bank, the country's inflation peaked at 8.3% at the end of 2022. Prime Minister Aziz Ahanouch has, however, promised to strengthen market control and lower prices in the coming days. China vehemently denies U.S. accusations that it is planning to send military aid to Russia for the war in Ukraine. China's foreign ministry spokesman countered that it is the Americans who are endlessly shipping weapons to the battlefield. Wang Wenbin also reiterated a call to support a Chinese proposal to find a political solution to the Ukraine crisis. Beijing says it will publish the proposal this week. The U.S. has warned that any move by Beijing to provide Moscow with lethal support would seriously damage bilateral relations. The EU has issued a similar warning. The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has met with the Omani Sultan Haytham bin Darik al-Said during his one-day visit to Muscat. Assad and the Omani Sultan discussed regional issues and the expansion of bilateral ties. Sultan Haytham also extended his condolences to the Syrian president and the victims of the recent devastating earthquakes. Bashar al-Assad, for his part, thanked the Omani nation and government for their solidarity with the Syrian people in the aftermath of the quakes. Assad's trip comes amid moves by a number of Arab countries to mend fences with Damascus after cutting off ties following foreign-backed militancy in the country in 2011. Countries including Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates have already restored ties with Syria since Syrian armed forces effectively defeated foreign-backed militancy. We've asked journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier about the significance of Assad's visit to Oman.
It is indeed significant because it's an ouverture of President Assad visiting more than one Arab and Middle Eastern country, and also receiving, as you rightly said, the visit of the Jordanian foreign minister for the first time since years. So what we understand is that the earthquake is pushing all the Arab countries to have another look through a humanitarian window rather than the political aspect when dealing with the Syrian president, the Syrian government, and the Syrian population. Not only, we've seen also European countries like Italy, Greece, Cyprus, and Austria calling their European state members to accept the status quo and to acknowledge the presence of an elected president in Syria, and that whatever has been done in the past, we need to go over it. And they're calling to stop the to stop the boycott, to start the reconstruction, to all the sanctions, and to look toward the future, to build the future relationship with Syria rather than staying on the side. However, the war in Ukraine is keeping everybody busy. This is why the earthquake has attracted some attention, but it is not clear for how long this attention will be.
And that is for this additional World News. It's bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight. human rights group Al-Mizan has found that the Zionist regime's drones or unmanned aerial vehicles have killed at least 2,146 Palestinians and damaged 3,332 homes from 2000 to 2022. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, Atallah al-Attar, 35, gets anxious in the evenings. He lives on his family's farm in the town of Beit Lahia in northern Gaza Strip, close to the boundary with the occupied Palestinian territories. Evenings are when the Zionist regime's drones most often fly overhead. On this particular January afternoon, he softly explained why he has an acute fear of drones. He said, "The incident is very painful. In May 2019, he was working as a security guard at a wedding venue in Beit Lahia. He was taking a break with a friend, Khaled Abu Ghaligh, 24, when they saw and heard the Zionist regime drones flying overhead, which was not unusual. Al-Attar thought the drones were just surveilling the area, but then the men felt the explosion. Al-Attar said, the explosion made a huge sound and the shrapnel from the missile flew at us. Shrapnel hit Al-Attar in the eye and the legs. The pain was excruciating, but he mostly recalls his friends' cries for help. One moment, Al-Attar remembers, Abu Alir was eating a meal and drinking coffee in nearby shipping container. The next, debris and shrapnel had hit Abu Ghaligh in the head. And by the time an ambulance arrived, he was unconscious. It was while Al-Attar was receiving treatment for his wounds at the hospital that he learned of Abu Ghaligh's death. A subsequent Human Rights Watch report stated that the Zionist regime drone had bombed a metal shipping container outside a businessman's villa and found that none of the individuals killed or injured by the Zionist strike had any ties to armed Palestinian groups. Doctors amputated Al-Attar's foot, and he now walks with crutches. He has four children, but he is currently unable to work, neither as a security guard nor on his family's farm, harvesting strawberries and grain. He said, Israeli regime drones are not only for reconnaissance and killing. They also sabotage water farms by spraying pesticides. I have seen this before, and the drones give me constant anxiety. They killed my friend, and they almost killed me. The Zionist regime began using drones in the extrajudicial killings of Palestinians in 2004, according to Al-Mizan, and nearly a decade later, they have grown to be the most lethal weapons, particularly in assassinations and attacks on crowds. Drones have much longer flying times, states Human Rights Watch, and some are able to operate continuously for more than 24 hours. Military researcher Yusuf Al-Sharghawi, a retired Palestinian Authority major general, said that the Zionist regime's most used drones in Gaza are the quadcopter and the Hermes 450, the latter of which conducts nighttime surveillance with its infrared sensors and can carry missiles. He said drones take videos, track and assassinate. They also direct bomber aircrafts. Israel is looking to develop these drones to have the most powerful drones in the West Asia region, but in Gaza, they are the most lethal weapons and violate international humanitarian law. Palestinian factions have downed drones in Gaza, most recently on January 27th, and with Hamas saying that important sensitive information was obtained. The Israeli regime's war on Gaza during the summer of 2014 brutally demonstrated the destructive reach of drones. While Defense for Children International Palestine found evidence suggesting that Israeli regime forces directly targeted children that summer, with drones killing at least 164 children, other attacks carried out by the Zionist regime throughout Gaza targeted many more civilians. Anwar al-Zanin, 43, an employee of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, had reported that an Israeli regime strike had damaged a water line near his home in northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun, and the municipality sent workers to repair it. Sofyan Abu Harbit, 49, and Majdi Shabat, 50, were repairing the water line when an Israeli regime drone dropped yet another missile nearby. All three men were injured by the strike and taken to the hospital. Abu Harbid's leg was fractured, and Shabbat sustained injuries to his back, arms, and hands. Azanin was more seriously wounded and died later. Now, Abu Harbit refuses to work while Israeli regime drones are in the sky, as the attack produced a lasting psychological trauma. "The event is still terrifying me," he said, adding, "At first, the presence of drones just meant it was monitoring our movements, but now the army intends to hurt and kill us from all directions, sea, land, and air. The Israeli army can kill us without justification." Hala Abu Hajar, 38, lives in the village of Johr, east of Gaza City. She is a widow and the mother of four children. "Drones are active in the area," she explains. Like Al-Attar, who was injured by the drone strike in Beit Lahia, Abu Hajar also notes that the drones come out most often in the evenings. They are so high-pitched and loud and deafening vibration that it feels like they are another occupant in her home. During the 2014 war, she was walking with her children when she saw an Israeli regime drone drop missiles on a car and a motorcycle. "She's now more afraid of drones than warplanes," she said. "Sometimes when my children are playing near the house and they hear the sound of drones, they run back into the house. They are afraid the drones are going to bomb them." She believes their fear is justified, and she's also afraid. "Evenings at home should be peaceful," she said, "but the drones make this impossible. There is barely a moment when she's not thinking of the drones and what they are capable of. The attacks feel unpredictable, even though their buzzing sound is unmistakable," she said. "Whenever I hear the drones, I feel danger nearby. Tension, headaches, anxiety, and sometimes I can't sleep." According to Mehr News Agency, the Zionist regime withdrew its troops from Gaza in 2005. 2 years later, though, the regime imposed a crippling blockade on the Palestinian territory after the Islamic resistance movement Hamas rose to power there. Ever since, the regime of Tel Aviv has waged three wholesale wars on the territory, Observers say the combination of the siege and military assaults is meant to render what is already the world's largest open-air prison even more uninhabitable. Over the past months, the fabricated regime of Israel has also ramped up attacks on Palestinian towns and cities throughout the occupied territories. As a result of these attacks, dozens of Palestinians have lost their lives and many others have been arrested. More than 170 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, were killed across the West Bank and East Al-Quds last year. In January 2023 alone, well over 30 Palestinians, including 5 children, have been killed. The United Nations marked 2022 as the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank in 16 years.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Academics who criticise the Israeli regime and who speak out in support of the Palestinian people are being targeted and smeared. Some have had their professional careers ruined by outrageous calumnies. The prestigious Harvard University is one of the institutions where pro-Palestinian academics have been singled out. So in this week's programme, we're going to be lifting the veil on some of Harvard's powerful funders and senior figures in the university. I'll be talking to acclaimed academics about these shameful dirty tricks after this special report by Latifa Abu-Chakra.
Harvard University in the United States has been embroiled in controversy after the administration cancelled the appointment of former executive director of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, as a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. Human Rights Watch has rendered significant services to US imperialism, regularly providing damning reports on the official enemies of empire, often based on questionable sources. However, the one red line that Human Rights Watch and Ken Roth crossed was the Palestine line. It was said that Roth was refused his appointment due to his anti-Israel bias. In 2021, Human Rights Watch joined other liberal organizations to condemn the Zionist entity as practicing apartheid in the illegally occupied West Bank and Gaza. Oh, how late these bastions of human rights were to recognize the suffering of our people. The decision to cancel Ken Roth's appointment apparently fell to Doug Elmendorf, the dean of faculty at the Harvard Kennedy School. Elmendorf is also a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. The Brookings Institution is funded by the Israel Institute, the U.S. military and arms companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon. The Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings Institution was established by major Israeli military funder Chaim Sabin. The fellows there included the former head of Shin Bet, Avi Dichter, and the head of research for Israeli military intelligence, Yossi Kupferwasser. Eventually, following public outcry over Ken Roth, Harvard was seen to reverse its decision to cancel him. Doug Elmendorf writes, "In the case of Mr. Roth, I now believe that I made an error in my decision not to appoint him as a fellow at our Carr Center for Human Rights. I am sorry the decision inadvertently cast doubt on the mission of the school and our commitment to open debate in ways I had not intended and do not believe to be true. So all is well that ends well. Or is it? Ken Roth is far from the first person to be excluded from Harvard on this basis. In fact, U.S. academic Cornel West claims that he was refused tenure at Harvard in 2021 due to the heavily pro-Israel donors at the prestigious university. It is also reported that the biologist Robert Trivers was disinvited from giving a lecture at Harvard in 2007 following an intervention from a major donor to the university. This donor was none other than convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who is reported by close confidants to have gathered compromat for Israeli intelligence. Epstein, along with Israeli lobbyist Alan Dershowitz, opposed Trivers' visit due to his previous criticism of Israel. Freedom of speech, or even freedom of thought, seem to be under threat at Harvard University."
As ever, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. He's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch, and he's recently been appointed as a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zaim University. Our guest expert today is Shahad Abu Salama. She is a Palestinian writer, activist and artist. Shahad was an associate lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University, but she was defamed and harassed by Zionist publications and was then suspended from her job. However, after a short but intense campaign, she was reinstated to her position. We spoke to Shahad earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, tell us about Human Rights Watch and Ken Roth.
So Human Rights Watch have famously joined a number of other human rights organisations, Amnesty, B'Tselem, etc., and described Israel as an apartheid state, you know, which it plainly is. And that has been the reason why he was initially denied his position at Harvard by the dean, Elmendorf. Mm. And then, of course, there was an outcry about it, and they were forced on the back foot to go back on it. And his position's now been reinstated. So there's a kind of interesting tug of war going on here. So his criticisms of Israel are by no means radical criticisms. I mean, the idea that Israel is an apartheid state is not a radical idea anymore. It's something which is par for the course. Everybody knows this. But to say it in public discourse is the thing which is still a taboo. And so that's what he fell foul of. But the interesting thing is that they've been forced on the back foot over this. And the dean who took the decision has apologised for his decision-making.
Interesting development there. But I asked Shahad what the latest news was on her case at Sheffield Hallam University.
As for my developments my case at Sheffield Hallam University, I've been unfortunately stabbed in the back again by my now ex-employer, Sheffield Hallam. I officially ended my position on the 10th of October 2022, and that's after I was hounded by unjust investigations, one after the other, three in total, and I've been exonerated of all of them. But basically, I chose then to move on and look for an anti-racist, a genuinely anti-racist, anti-colonial organization where I feel I would thrive and not be subject to constant harassment and defamation. So that was unfortunately my wishful thinking, because nearly a month after this happened, I learn again from the Zionist press, namely the Jewish Chronicle, in a in a very shockingly, I mean, not shocking, to be honest, we're used to this level of harassment and smears and demonizations. But they basically went yet again attacking me and then framing me as a threat to the Jewish community, despite being yet again exonerated in an investigation that had just concluded, and the spokesperson, the deputy chief of Sheffield Hallam, Mr. Calvert, had actually allowed the breach of some confidential information to the Jewish Chronicle.
David, I wonder whether you could say a word or two about Douglas Elmendorf and the significance of him being a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Well, Elmendorf has these various positions. He's the dean at Harvard. He's a senior fellow at Brookings, which is a think tank which is funded by the arms industry, but also by Zionist organisations. Actually, he's also a fellow at the Blavatnik Institute at the University of Oxford in the UK, in this country. So he has a number of different connections with what are effectively Zionist outfits. The Brookings has taken funds from the Zionists, has a centre set up by Chaim Saban, one of the key Zionist funders in the US, Blavatnik in this country, key Zionist funder. So he's well into that nexus. And of course, you wouldn't be surprised, given that he would have taken the decision that he did, which is all the more striking that he was forced to recant on his decision. And that's unusual. I mean, someone who had taken the decision as a kind of liberal would be more likely, you would think, to recant. But that must have been a lot of pressure for him to recant on that.
Mm. Well, I also asked Shahad why she thinks that Ken Roth was accused of being anti-Israel, while the rest of us, including her, were smeared by being accused of indulging in anti-Semitism.
It's, of course, it's ideological weaponization of terms. It's the same applies to terrorism. You know, someone's terrorist is another one's freedom fighter, and who's a freedom fighter in West media is mostly determined by the powerful and those who are legitimately, for example, fighting against colonialism and apartheid are being demonized as terrorists because the occupier, the apartheid power, is an ally of these Western regimes.
David, what were the notorious Jeffrey Epstein's links with Israel, and how does that relate to Harvard?
Well, you saw in the film there, I mean, the well-known statement that he gathered compromise on behalf of Mossad. His co-conspirator, Robert Maxwell's daughter, Shalane, was also, it seems, involved in that. It seems like the whole Maxwell family were assets of Mossad, including her two brothers. I think she has one other sister. So it's an involvement there. And it seems to have been that the whole operation was allowed to proceed effectively by Mossad in order that they could gain the compromise. But Epstein himself had donated over $700,000, I think it was, between being arrested and convicted to Harvard as part of his strategy to launder his image, I guess. And he had been involved also in trying to stop certain people speaking at Harvard. So that's the really interesting little snippet here, is that he was not only was being used as an asset by Mossad, but actually also trying to promote Israel's interests by censoring people in terms of public discourse. And he was very closely connected in that sense by a guy called Wexner, who we might come on to in a minute, who ran Victoria's Secret, a huge Zionist donor, including to Harvard as well.
Mm. Well, I then asked Shahad how things in the UK compare to the US and whether it's actually worse there than it is here.
It's not better or worse. It's very similar. We are seeing a pattern, you know, between all these settler colonial states, actually. It's not... it's not shocking to see the US, for example, consistently silencing Palestinian voices and pro-Palestine voices.
Well, we've now got another report now on Zionist donors to Harvard University and the role that they may have played in the cancellation of pro-Palestinian voices.
Following our examination of some of the academics and public figures cancelled by Harvard University for their pro-Palestinian positions, it is important we delve into the considerable Zionist connections of key donors and high-ranking figures within the university. The first donor worthy of examination is Thomas S. Kaplan, the well-known entrepreneur and member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has been instrumental in a foundation named after his late mother, the Lillian Jean Kaplan Foundation, which has funded the settler organization, the Temple Institute, which is working to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque and replace it with a Jewish temple. Kaplan was also on the board of the 92nd Street Y Cultural Center in New York, which canceled a talk by Dr. Izzeldin Aboulesh, who lost three family members to the Israeli military. Thomas Kaplan also funds the Rekanati Kaplan Intelligence Fellows, which trains figures from U.S. and Israeli intelligence. Another key donor who might have asserted influence over these cancellations is the billionaire Leslie Wexner. He funds the Wexner Israel Fellowship at the university as part of the Center for Public Leadership. The fellowship aims to provide Israel's next generation of public leaders with superlative training in public management and leadership development. Graduates of the program include Shin Bet Chief, Ami Ayalon, and four major generals, Yedidi Ayari, Shea Avital, Amos Yadlin, and Yohanan Locker, later Netanyahu's military secretary. In 2016, the Israeli regime listed the Wexner Foundation on a list of public sector reserve programs organized directly by the Israeli Prime Minister's office. The next figure at the Harvard Kennedy School with significant links to Israel is Eden Offer, who sits on the Dean's Executive Board alongside his wife. Shipping billionaire Eden Offer's companies are reported as being used by Israeli intelligence to transport agents through the Middle East in key assassinations. It is believed the Offer family ships were used to transport agents who killed Mahmoud al-Manhouf, chief of logistics and weapons procurement for the military wing of Palestinian resistance group Hamas. Another key funder is Robert Belfer, who sits on the board of governors at Israeli lobby group, the American Jewish Committee. He also works closely with Israeli lobby group, the Anti-Defamation League. Another example of the pro-Israel bias that exists at Harvard Kennedy School is the addition of former Israeli military general Amos Yadlin, who also sits as the executive director of the Israeli intelligence think tank, the Institute for National Security Studies, as a Harvard senior fellow lecturing students. There is clearly a high level of influence from Zionist lobbyists in key positions of Harvard University.
David, tell us a bit more about the Temple Institute and Thomas Kaplan, who's a key funder of Harvard, isn't he?
Yeah, so the Temple Institute, which we've covered in this show before, is an organization based in occupied Al-Quds in Jerusalem, which is dedicated to the demolition, you heard that correctly, the demolition of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the replacement of it by a Jewish temple as part of their notion that this will bring the Day of Reckoning a little bit closer. So it's an extreme settler organization, and it's supported by this guy Kaplan, who's a billionaire, one of the key funders of Harvard. And you can see the connections here. This is a connection we've found time and time again on this show. People who are funding pro-Israel stuff in the US or the UK or other Western European countries are also engaged directly in funding illegal settlement activity, which is directly involved and implicated in the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
Mm. Well, Shahad then told us what she made of Amos Yadlin, the former head of Israeli military intelligence, being able to lecture at Harvard University.
This is literally another example of how we see, as Palestinians, our oppression being normalized on all platforms. similar to this warmonger or even war criminal, and we see people like him always using places, our universities, the media, platforms like this in order to legitimate their crimes against the Palestinians.
David, I mean, you mentioned earlier in the one of your previous answers about Leslie Wexner. I mean, he not only seems to be key to Israeli government operations, but he was also linked to Epstein's role in the university, wasn't he?
Yeah, him and Epstein were mates, and they were involved in donating together. You can see there one of the buildings. There are buildings named after all sorts of different Zionist donors, yes, in Harvard, just as there are in Oxford and Cambridge.
Sure.
Extraordinary, when you start to add them all up, the amount of them. And Wexner, of course, is Victoria's Secret, and you know, there's an industry which is not unadjacent to the stuff which Epstein was supposed to be getting up to with his Lolita Express and his private island, and the trafficking of young girls and women to be sexually exploited for the production of compromise. So there's a clear set of a nexus here, and an attempt to, in a way, to give a positive public image to that nexus by donation to one of the most prestigious universities, the most prestigious university in the US, which of course is Harvard. So that's what's going on here.
I wonder whether you could say also a word or two about Idan Ofer. There seems to be quite a sinister element to that story. I mean, the guy's also active in London, isn't he?
So the Ofer family is the big shipping family, and as we heard in the film there, they were involved. It's been publicly noted now that they've been involved in allowing their ships to be used by Mossad for ops, including operations in Iran. So they were traveling to Iran, and there were stories about this. They're breaking the boycott of Iran. Mm. Well, actually, they were doing it at the behest of Mossad, so they could transport their operatives to undertake assassinations and murders in Iran. I mean, that's the direct role there. But in terms of the Harvard connection, yes, there's a connection at Harvard, and there's the programs named after Ofer, but just as there are in other places. For example, in the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya in occupied Palestine, which is the only private university there and which reserves 20% of its places for elite military or intelligence personnel, there's an Ofer Center there, Sami Ofer Center, named after Aydin's dad, Sami Ofer. In London, there's a Sami Ofer building just near Regent's Park, which is part of the London Business School. So that the money is sprayed around all over the place as a means to launder the image of these people who are engaged effectively in terrorism.
Mm. Well, Shahad also gave us her thoughts on how she thinks the story is going to develop and whether we're likely to see more victories on the horizon.
The tide is changing, and I think Israel is probably helping us by electing even more and more extremist governments, although all governments systematically and firmly, left and right, have been unified when it comes to the domination and the occupation of the Palestinians. But what is happening recently in Palestine is definitely worrying. We count on the sumud of the Palestinian people and their continued existence and resistance in the face of the illegal occupier. And we count on all those people of conscience that are rising and seeing all these paradoxes that are around us.
And finally, David, I wonder whether you could tell us about this other funder, Robert Balfour.
Yes, it's the Belfer Center at Harvard, which is kind of a think tank based at Harvard. And Belfer, again, a key Zionist funder. So you see a picture here of a really rather large number of very significant Zionist funders. We haven't listed all of them in this show, but the ones we've listed are already enough to show a very significant influence of Zionist money in the university in general and in the social sciences and social and political sciences in general. And, of course, if that means that someone at Harvard happens to produce some decent research, I'm sure the decent research could be published, unless, of course, it is in any way critical of Zionism or the Zionist entity. And that's how this works. That, you know, it's not even that people are necessarily totally censored, which, of course, does happen, but that if they did come up with anything decent, any decent piece of work which is critical of Israel, it would be stopped.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time again today. Thanks to our guests, Shahad Abu Salama, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. The revelations in today's programme are ignored by the corporate media, so please share the information we've provided today to help expose these